Just a quick note before we get started. There is one swear word in this episode, and it comes pretty close to the beginning of the story. But we just wanted to give you a heads up. Okay, here we go. From Gimlet Media, this is Undone. I'm Pat Walters. About an hour up the shore of Lake Michigan from Chicago, there's a little beach town called Harbert, Michigan. People from the city go up on the weekends, but only about 1,000 people live there full-time. And most of them have lived there their whole lives or moved from Chicago to retire or find some peace and quiet. But there's this one guy in town who came to Harbert from really, really far away. His name is Ibrahim Parlak, and he's originally from the mountains of Turkey. When our story starts, about 10 years ago, Ibrahim was running a little restaurant called Cafe Gulistan. And the things people would say about him made him sound like the embodiment of the American dream. The short version of his story goes like this. Ibrahim came to the United States in 1991. He learned English, got a job, and made lots of friends. He fell in love and had a daughter. He worked really hard, saved money, bought a house, and opened his restaurant. And he surrounded the place with these pink and purple flowers called hollyhocks because they reminded him of home. And everybody says he's one of the nicest people in town.
He's just a human being that would give you the shirt off his back.
This is Marty Goldrick, one of Ibrahim's closest friends.
We met in 1998 playing tennis together Sunday mornings.
Marty told me when he says Ibrahim would have given you the shirt off his back, he's not exaggerating. One time, a homeless man came into Ibrahim's restaurant, and after making the man a meal, Ibrahim took off his jacket and gave it to the man. Marty says he did stuff like this all the time. Here's another friend of Ibrahim's named Martin.
When I was between jobs, I had really no money. I came to his restaurant once and he saw my tires on my car.
They were pretty much bald.
So he gave me his Sears credit card and said, go to Sears and buy yourself four new tires. And I'm like, no, Ibrahim, I'm good.
So that was the story everybody told about Ibrahim. Model immigrant, great neighbor, dad, friend. And then in 2004, kind of out of nowhere, a really different one surfaced.
The U.S. government has accused him of lying on his citizenship application and of supporting a terrorist group.
People who are charged with terrorist activities.
Parlak has been in the United States for 14 years, but now is accused of being a terrorist.
I remember thinking, shit, what is this?
This is Michelle Gazzolo. She's one of Ibrahim's best friends, and they have a daughter together. Ibrahim had been arrested. And when Michelle found out, she called the jail and told the woman who answered the phone,
I think there's some mistake. And she said, oh, you know, he's a murderer.
The Department of Homeland Security had accused Ibrahim of being in a terrorist group called the PKK. A DHS spokeswoman told reporters, if his neighbors knew what the government knew, they'd never want to live next to this guy. But his friend said, that just can't be possible.
I just couldn't believe that all these things they were saying about Ibrahim could actually be true.
Ibrahim's tennis partner, Marty.
How could he be this terrorist? It just wasn't making any sense.
And so this is the question for our episode. Is this man, Ibrahim Parlak, a terrorist? And what exactly does it mean to be called a terrorist in America today?
I heard about Ibrahim's arrest, and so I visited his restaurant.
This is Alex Kotlowitz. He's a journalist who lives in Chicago, and he's who I heard about this story from in the first place. Alex says he went out there in 2004, and when he got to the restaurant, Ibrahim's family and friends were having a potluck.
And it was pretty incredible, all this support he had, scores of friends and neighbors who completely believed in him.
And what did you, think about this on that first visit?
You know, honestly, I was skeptical. I mean, keep in mind, this was 3 years after 9/11, and the government was understandably hypervigilant. I mean, we all were at that time. And I figured the government knew what they were doing.
But Alex was also intrigued. Like, there were these two stories about this guy. One the government had, another his community had. And Alex wondered, who is he really? So he got a magazine assignment from the New York Times and went to meet Ibrahim.
I went to the county jail where he's being held along with all these other immigrants. The guards put us in this windowless room. Ibrahim's a slender man and quite soft-spoken. He's 42, but what really struck me about him is that he looked really haggard. His jail uniform hung off of his shoulders, and it was pretty apparent he'd lost some weight. The first thing he wanted to talk about was his 7-year-old daughter, Livia, who he clearly adores. He told me that with toothpaste, he attached photos of her to a sheet of cardboard, which he periodically put up by his bed.
And eventually, after chatting for a while, Alex said, "Tell me who you are. Just start at the beginning."
Ibrahim told me he grew up in a little village in the mountains of Turkey. His dad was a farmer, wheat, cotton, watermelons. But the thing that defined Ibrahim's childhood, and in a way the rest of his life, was the fact that he was Kurdish.
I didn't know anything about the Kurds when Alex first told me about Ibrahim's story. But they're a group of people in a really unusual situation. The Kurds are the largest ethnic minority in the world that have no country of their own. The biggest group of them live in the mountains of Turkey, where Ibrahim is from. There are about 14 million Kurds there. But Turkey doesn't want them, never has, and treats the Kurds really badly.
Ibrahim told me that when he was growing up, and I know this sounds kind of unbelievable, but he was forbidden from speaking Kurdish outside his home.
Any expression of ethnic identity is seen as a threat to the nation.
This is a friend of mine named Stephen Kinzer. He's been writing about Turkey for the past 20 years. And he says it was actually illegal to speak the Kurdish language in public. It was illegal to celebrate festivals, to display art, really just about anything related to being Kurdish.
And Kinzer says that beginning in the late 70s, just as Ibrahim was growing up, Turkish oppression intensified.
Hundreds of villages were burned to the ground. The government was sponsoring death squads roaming around, kidnapping people off the street and torturing them to death.
Ibrahim was a teenager at the time, and all this violence, as you can imagine, had a big effect on him. He told me he started going to marches, and eventually he got arrested and spent 3 months in prison. It was really dangerous to be an activist. So when he got released, Ibrahim fled the country, and he ended up in Germany.
This is where we get to the PKK, the group the U.S. calls a terrorist organization and says Ibrahim was working with. In those days, the PKK was a new Kurdish rights organization. And while he was in Germany, Ibrahim did political work for them, writing articles and putting on events. But while Ibrahim was in Germany doing that, back in Turkey, the PKK changed. They armed themselves and started fighting for a separate Kurdish state. They bombed government buildings, assassinated Turkish officials. Mostly, they targeted police and military, but they'd killed civilians too.
And this is where things get really thorny for Ibrahim. He told me that after 7 years away, he wanted to go home.
But he couldn't just hop on a plane. Ibrahim says because he was a Kurdish activist, Turkey had revoked his passport. So the only way for him to get back into the country was with the help of the PKK.
So in 1988, he flew from Germany to a PKK training camp in northern Lebanon.
I think it was in the Baka Valley. And, you know, so I'm like, okay, well, I've heard of terrorist camps in the Baka Valley.
This is a local attorney named Ann Buckleitner.
I just remember hearing him say the names of places that I was familiar with, and that giving me a great deal of pause.
Anne started visiting Ibrahim after reading about his case in the newspaper. And she knew the names of these places because of her previous job.
I worked in Washington, D.C. There I did both counterterrorism and counterintelligence work for the FBI.
Anne was an attorney who worked on international counterterrorism at the FBI. She was there when Osama bin Laden was emerging as the most wanted terrorist in the world. And she'd left a couple years before 9/11. She moved to this small town in Michigan, thinking that she'd left that part of her life behind. And now, all of a sudden, this local guy was accused of being a terrorist. When Anne first visited Ibrahim in jail, she remembers,
they were very careful at when I would go in to see Ibrahim. You know, like, I remember them taking away my binder clips because, you know, that they could be turned into shivs. And I think they even took the staples out of my legal papers I would be taken in to show them.
And when Anne sat down with Ibrahim, he told her his story too, about growing up in Turkey, being persecuted for being a Kurd, getting political, and eventually ending up at this PKK camp to sneak back into Turkey.
And I'm listening and trying to sort through in my mind, is this, how bad a legal trouble is he in, and is this a guy I want to be involved with?
And then Ibrahim told Anne the part of the story that was at the heart of the U.S. government's case against him. He said he did not approve of the armed tactics of the PKK. But as he was sneaking back into Turkey, something violent happened.
He was with some men from the PKK, and as they were crossing into the country, they were discovered by some Turkish soldiers. There was this firefight, and two Turkish soldiers ended up dead. Ibrahim was eventually captured and convicted. The police wanted information about the PKK, so they tortured him and threatened his family. Eventually, Ibrahim gave in and told them the location of where the PKK had buried some weapons. And so after a year and a half in prison, he was released. He was scared, so he fled the country again. And this time, he came to the U.S.
And we gave him asylum, took him in and said, "You're safe here." So Anne is wondering, how did we as a country go from embracing this man, thinking of him as someone who needed protection, to calling him a terrorist? She eventually does some research and finds out that when Ibrahim came here in 1991, the U.S. didn't have the PKK on its list of terrorist groups.
It was not a designated terrorist organization at the time he had any proximity to it.
That didn't happen until the late 1990s, 6 years after Ibrahim got to the U.S. And it wasn't until Ibrahim applied for citizenship that his case got flagged. By then, he'd built his life in Michigan. He had the restaurant, his daughter, all of his friends. And knowing all this, Anne is thinking,
do we have a national security interest in keeping this guy out of the country? Is this really a bad guy?
And after reviewing all the evidence, Anne decided she didn't think so. From her time in the FBI, she knew what a terrorist looked like. And in her mind, Ibrahim wasn't one. So Anne joined a team of lawyers defending Ibrahim. And in November of 2004, they went to court.
I would like to briefly talk about the terrorism charges.
This is the prosecutor. His name is Mark Jepson. And the case he presented against Ibrahim did not look good for him.
He witnessed training in rocket launchers. He went to cities, did surveillance, his group took pictures. He buried arms, ammunition, built shelters.
And Jepson argued that Ibrahim wasn't just some innocent guy working for a Kurdish rights group.
He said when he snuck across the border, Ibrahim had an AK-47 and at least one grenade. At the training camp, he'd even met with the leader of the PKK. They played soccer together.
Mr. Parlak is literally the complete terrorist package.
I'll never forget that particular phrase, the complete terrorist package. I was never seeing that he was any terrorist package.
After Jepson finished, Anne presented her defense. And she didn't really dispute that much of what Jepson had said about Ibrahim. For instance, she said, yes, Ibrahim did have a gun, but he hadn't fired it. The Turkish investigation into the shooting had confirmed this.
What really stood out to me was that there was this general agreement about the facts, just not on what they meant. Take the soccer thing, for instance. Ibrahim didn't deny he played soccer with the PKK leader, but that didn't make them friends. He told Anne that playing soccer with the PKK leader almost put him on the leader's bad side. Ibrahim wouldn't let up on him, and he kept trying to keep the guy from scoring.
Reading through the transcripts of this hearing, you see that the two sides had these completely different interpretations of pretty much every fact of the case. And the biggest difference in interpretation, the one at the heart of it, was something arguably rather small, a missed translation. DHS said when Ibrahim applied for asylum, he lied on his application, that he didn't disclose the fact that those two Turkish soldiers died when he was sneaking across the border. Ibrahim says he did disclose it, that he included a newspaper report about the incident in his asylum application. But when the article was translated, the Turkish soldiers were left out. And Ibrahim didn't notice because he didn't speak English yet.
The newspaper article's there, in the file. I've seen it. And in translation, it says exactly what Ibrahim claimed.
And as this hearing went on, it became clear it was less about what Ibrahim did or didn't do, and more about how we see him. In the time since Ibrahim had come to the United States, our definition of what a terrorist is had changed. Remember, this is only 3 years after 9/11. That day had changed the way we see the present, but it had also changed the way we look at the past. Remember, when Ibrahim was involved with the PKK, we didn't even consider it a terrorist organization. But through the lens of 9/11, Ibrahim looked to DHS like a terrorist.
But when he was on the stand, Ibrahim said he was something else.
He said, "I am a fighter."
As in, a freedom fighter.
That would not have been my choice of words for him. You know, this is a time for him to be establishing he's not a threat to the U.S. national security, which I firmly believe he has never been. And then he clarified, people who have cancer are fighters. I fight for human rights.
But of course, the prosecution had a totally different take on that.
To say that he was a freedom fighter is ridiculous. There are many people in this world, many governments would claim Osama bin Laden is a freedom fighter. He is not a freedom fighter. He is a terrorist. The evidence showed that Mr. Parr...
The way the prosecution talked about Ibrahim made him seem incredibly dangerous. I mean, basically comparing him to Osama bin Laden. But the truth is, DHS never directly alleged he was a threat to the U.S., which makes you wonder, why were they so determined to deport him? We asked DHS to do an interview to explain, but they declined. Outside the courthouse, Ibrahim's friends from home were protesting. To them, Ibrahim wasn't a freedom fighter or a terrorist. He was their neighbor, the guy who cooked lamb and flatbread for them at his restaurant on Friday evenings.
Ibrahim's daughter, Livia, who was 7 at the time, was out there wearing a t-shirt that read, "Free my dad." And it wasn't just Ibrahim's family and the usual liberal activist types you'd expect to be protesting.
I'm a former Marine officer and kind of a salute and follow, but this really turned that all upside down for me.
Remember Marty from the top who played tennis with Ibrahim? He's a politically conservative former vice president of the Whirlpool Corporation. And here he was in a poncho with Free Ibrahim painted on the back.
I never protested anything in my life except in Detroit the day of his trial. And it was rainy and cold, and but we were motivated to protect Ibrahim from what they were doing.
Ibrahim had brought together a lot of unlikely allies. Remember, he's being defended by a former FBI counterterrorism attorney. Another of his lawyers was a former U.S. attorney who had been appointed by Reagan. A local police officer had come out in support, and the owner of a competing restaurant raised $25,000 for his legal fees.
Everyone in Ibrahim's community knew how much was at stake. Back inside the courtroom, Ibrahim's lawyers explained that if Ibrahim was sent back to Turkey, he would be tortured. It had already happened to him once.
Can you describe that for the court?
We're held in a small cell.
And during the torture testimony, Ibrahim testified about being kept in a cage and being made to stand in his feces. And he said the only food that they would give him, they would throw into the cage and grind it into the feces.
Even when they give you a piece of bread, they would blend it in there and give it to you.
And if you want to eat it, you go find it.
I had to eat my own. You know, they take you out.
After that testimony, there was a break. And Anne remembers the guards gave Ibrahim a moment to sit with his daughter, Livia.
And I saw that they brought in food for Ibrahim, and it was fried chicken. And Ibrahim was very meticulously debreading the chicken for Livia, and he was feeding her like a little bird. And I said something to him about, "You're taking the breading off." And he goes, "Oh, it's not good for her." And coming on the heels of the testimony about, you know, grinding his food into his feces, that was really striking to me.
After the hearing was all over, Ibrahim was escorted back to jail. A few weeks later, the judge issued her ruling.
She said Ibrahim was a terrorist and ordered him deported back to Turkey.
It was painful. In a place where I found a refuge that I didn't do anything wrong and did as a community member what I could to be part of, and being treated like that, and so you went to my cell and I closed the door and I cried.
After the break, we'll find out what happens next, and Alex and I go visit Ibrahim, where he lives now. So this trial happened 12 years ago, in 2004. Ibrahim Parlak, a Kurdish immigrant from Turkey who was beloved in his community, had been declared a terrorist, and an immigration judge ordered him deported back to Turkey. But then a strange thing happened. Turkey didn't want him back. Alex Kolowitz again.
So there was this question, what happens to him now? DHS wanted to keep him locked up, but Ibrahim's lawyers got him released on bail, $50,000 raised by his friends and family back in Harbert.
His many friends and supporters could hardly contain their excitement at his return.
We love you.
People were all around and waving and just kind of, it was amazing.
That was a tears of joy situation. We had Free Ibrahim t-shirts on and signs, and we really had gone all out.
I remember being incredibly happy that he was back.
Ibrahim's daughter, Livia.
And there were all these people there that wanted to hug him, and I just wanted him for myself.
But this reunion had this cloud hanging over it.
Turkey didn't want Ibrahim, but the U.S. had ordered him deported, and if Turkey changed their mind at any moment and offered to take him back, Ibrahim would have to go.
They could have just deported me right then.
Ibrahim's supporters scrambled around trying to figure out how to keep him here.
And finally, they did, by getting two more unlikely allies involved. Here's the first one.
Fred Upton, U.S. Congressman from Southwest Michigan.
Fred Upton's a Republican who entered Congress during the Reagan years. After the immigration court's decision, neighbors and friends of Ibrahim's contacted Upton.
There were hundreds of people. They wrote handwritten letters and others in support of him.
Some of Ibrahim's friends even flew out to Washington, D.C. to meet with Upton personally. And he was so moved by the story that he reached out to Ibrahim.
I met with him and, you know, he's a wonderful man. Father, runs a pretty decent restaurant, has employees there that think the world of him.
The way he saw it, all of this outweighed whatever Ibrahim might have been involved with back in Turkey.
He is exactly the type of guy, immigrant, that we want to come to this country and to succeed. He's done it the right way.
Fred Upton wasn't the only lawmaker who'd been getting letters from Ibrahim's friends.
He's one of the last people who ought to be deported to a country which is likely to torture him.
That's Democratic Senator Carl Levin. So these two men, a Democrat and a Republican, introduced a bill.
It's called a private bill, allows him to have status here, not citizenship, but just allowed to stay here.
A private bill is a law that applies to just one person. I'd never heard of this before. They're pretty rare. But it's a thing lawmakers can do, and this one basically said, Ibrahim is a model immigrant, and he should be allowed to stay. And this worked.
Having private bill was stopping the deportation.
And so Ibrahim's life kind of goes back to normal.
Yeah, just went back playing tennis, smoking, running a restaurant, being a dad, you know, volunteering, just being like a pretty happy, busy guy.
I was free as a bird.
At least it seemed that way at first. But as time went on, DHS didn't go anywhere.
They kind of pulled my wings.
In those first months after he got home,
I had to drive to Detroit every other week to report.
To show DHS he hadn't fled the state. Detroit's a 3-hour drive from Ibrahim's home.
After a while, DHS started letting him check in by phone. But that still meant that every Sunday morning, he would get a phone call very early, and he'd have only 3 minutes to pick it up.
So if he was in the shower, or if he overslept, or somehow missed the call,
he'd be subject to rearrest.
They also just continued to harass him.
Fred Upton again.
They figured out a way to make sure that he couldn't have a banking account.
Ibrahim says he felt his business was under threat.
They were threatening to take the liquor license.
Then they took away his health insurance.
I mean, they were trying to make a life miserable any way as possible. It's just like life, your life becomes like a groundhog movie. You know, every morning you get up, it's just you're living the same thing over and over.
It was really like the government, you know, DHS/ICE/INS. We're all sitting at our table. They were like members of our family.
Just to be clear here, all these things that are happening to Ibrahim are being done by a bunch of different government agencies. But to those around Ibrahim, it felt like a coordinated effort to make life difficult. DHS declined to comment on any of these claims.
Every 2 years, Upton and Levin reintroduced the private bill to protect Ibrahim. The bill actually never even got out of committee, but as long as it was introduced, Ibrahim was okay.
And this is how it goes for 10 years. Ibrahim keeps running the restaurant, playing tennis, watching his daughter Livia go from elementary school to high school to college, feeling mostly like he has his life back, but still kind of in limbo, sort of free, but not completely. And never feeling fully in control of his own life.
There always felt like there was a hand, like a puppeteer's hand, over everything. The sense that someone was jerking the strings, you know, and could do anything at any moment. There were times when he would say, you know, I'm afraid that I could just disappear. But none of us worried that something would happen like happened this past year.
In the fall of 2015, all the things Ibrahim had been fearing for the past decade started to unfold.
First, Senator Levin retired, which meant the private bill that had been protecting him lapsed. And without a private bill, Ibrahim was vulnerable to deportation.
And then Ibrahim gets a call from DHS telling him the thing he feared the most. Turkey wants you back, and we're sending you.
The conflict between Turkey and the Kurds had escalated again. In the summer of 2015, the PKK ended a 2-year ceasefire with Turkey, and ever since, clashes have increased. Turkey has jailed dozens of Kurdish politicians and shut down newspapers and charities. And on the other side, Kurdish militants have ramped up attacks. Just as we were finishing this episode, an offshoot of the PKK claimed responsibility for a bombing that killed more than 30 people. Turkey expert Stephen Kinzer again.
The new government's policy is Kurds are the unrelenting enemy. There's not going to be any further peace overtures. And therefore, any offenses in the recent past or in the distant past that have anything to do with the PKK are now going to be taken much more seriously.
And Fred Upton, the Republican congressman, figures that's why Turkey wants him back.
Now that he's a prominent Kurd, they'd like to make an example out of him. That's what I think. And I'm convinced that if he is forced to return there, that yes, he will be tortured, and yes, he will be killed.
It seemed that yet again, Ibrahim's fate had gotten caught up in this swirl of geopolitics. In 2004, it was 9/11.
Now it's Turkey's renewed conflict with the Kurds. And the ironic thing about the U.S. trying to deport Ibrahim is that in recent years, the Kurds have become one of our biggest allies in fighting ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And yet, here we are trying to deport a Kurd to a country he's certain will torture or kill him if he's sent there. We asked DHS to explain. They declined to comment. We also contacted the Turkish consulate, and they didn't get back to us.
They did, though, send Congressman Upton this letter where they called Ibrahim a PKK terrorist and referred to his case as a quote-unquote extradition of national security proportions.
And so at this point, Ibrahim prepared for the worst.
Put the house on the market, start transferring things on Livia's name, and you know, house title and business, and so registering Livia's name with the accounts, bank accounts, and all that stuff.
He gave me a list of phone numbers, and he said, if they come and take me, call this person, and then call this person.
Ibrahim's daughter, Livia, again.
The restaurant's in your name, so you can do what you want. I don't know, it was all suddenly very real, and I just wanted to be with him.
Ibrahim was certain that any day DHS might pick him up and put him on a plane back to Turkey.
This past August, Alex and I went to visit Ibrahim out in Michigan. And a few weeks before we got there, Ibrahim finally got some good news. He was getting a new hearing under the Conventions Against Torture. He needs to prove that if he's sent back to Turkey, there's a likelihood that he'll be tortured. The hearing will likely take place sometime next year.
Getting this relief isn't a sure thing at all, but Ibrahim can be pretty tenacious.
I think it energized him, actually.
Ibrahim's lawyer, Ann Buckleitner, again.
I mean, I think he survived off his wits. You know, there's a lot of dead Kurds, and Ibrahim's not one of them.
It's clear Ibrahim's friends so believe in him. They've been fighting for him for over 10 years, still holding fundraisers and potlucks at the restaurant. The night he learned Turkey wanted him returned, neighbors came to his house and spent the night thinking they could protect him if immigration came.
Ibrahim's tennis partner, Marty, was one of them.
I feel he'll be killed if he goes back and have volunteered to fly with him. Of course, ICE wouldn't allow that.
There's a kind of fearlessness among Ibrahim's friends. These days, Ibrahim keeps a go bag at the foot of his bed, just in case.
I knew they wouldn't let me take too much, but just one each.
You brought your slippers. You got your slippers there, too.
Slippers and, you know, anything that...
In it, he has just enough to last a few days. Some underwear, shirts, pants, toiletries, and a notebook with phone numbers of his family and friends.
For most of his life, Ibrahim has been a man without a country. Since he was a little boy, Turkey told him he wasn't wanted there. He came to the U.S., and first we welcomed him, and then we told him he wasn't wanted here either.
And what's made the last 12 years so painful for Ibrahim is that, unlike Turkey, he says in the U.S., he's finally found a country that feels like home. Despite all he's been through, this is the place he feels he truly belongs. Just a few months ago, Ibrahim did this kind of funny thing.
Can we get out and look around?
Even though he doesn't know how long he'll be able to stay, he bought this small piece of land.
The nicest thing, this whole forest is my backyard.
Some of it is really wild and out of hand and may never be tamed.
Ibrahim's friend, Michelle Gazzolo again.
These enormous trees that you can't even put your arms around.
There is no other tree like this one in the whole area.
It's maybe half an acre with an abandoned collapsing house and a garage both smack in the middle. The brush is so overgrown that there are places on the property you can't even walk. He wants to build one of those tiny houses on this land.
I'm just continuing with the same dream. And, you know, when the other thing comes along, then I deal with it. Then I had to go see the lawyer. Yes, I go see the lawyer. If DHS called me, I go see them. But then I come back, start doing my cooking, try to have enjoyment.
I guess I sort of see it as this kind of act of defiance.
Well, it's love and defiance. You know, it's like love for this place and love of his own freedom.
It just gives me enough to hold on to. Let's go see the garage. I mean, you got to see what they have. I mean, you know, when you purchase it, it was a first-time auction experience.
Undone is hosted and produced by me, Pat Walters, with Julia DeWitt and Emmanuel Berry. Our senior producer is Larissa Anderson. We are edited by Alan Burdick and Caitlin Kenny. Production assistance by Isabella Kulkarni. Undone is mixed and scored by Bobby Lord, with additional music by Nate Sandberg of Plaid Sound. Our fact checker is Michelle Harris. Special thanks to Alex Kotlowitz for bringing this story in and reporting it with us. Thanks also to Robert Carpenter and Dan Collison and Elizabeth Meister of Long Haul Productions. They provided a bunch of tape we used in this episode. You can check out their other stuff at longhaulpro.org. Undone was conceived in collaboration with our friends at Retro Report, the documentary film series that connects iconic news events of the past to today. You can find them at retroreport.org. If you want to get in touch, follow us on Twitter at Undone Show or email us at undone@gimletmedia.com. You can subscribe to Undone on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you heard, please write a review. It means a lot to us. We'll have a new episode next week. See you then. Hey, Pat here. So I wanted to play you a little clip from our next episode. We're going back to 1975 with this group of hippies in little tiny boats trying to get in between a giant whale and a huge Russian whaling ship. Here's one of them.
And then the captain on the harpoon vessel came down the catwalk and screamed into the ear of the harpooner. Then he looked at us and smiled and brought his finger across his throat. And that's when I realized that, we were seriously in trouble.
We'll hear more from him and some of the others. And we'll hear about how this super tight-knit group of teenagers and 20-somethings kicked off a movement to save the whales. And then grew up. Next week on Undone.